Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In the course of some 40 years working in that battle space, I have been privileged to know quite a few extraordinarily courageous figures. Few measure up, certainly in the moment, to our first guest in that regard. His name is Lord Malcolm Pearson, the Baron of Roenick in the United Kingdom, a post to which he was appointed by the great Margaret Thatcher when she was Prime Minister. He is a former leader of the United Kingdom's Independence Party. He has served with distinction in government, in the House of Lords and elsewhere. He has, of course, also been the recipient of an award that I particularly prize, issued by the Henry Jackson Society of Britain. It's called the Henry Scoop Jackson Award for Values and Vision in Politics, a distinction that he is certainly deserving of. He has just produced, at the beginning of the new year, and posted on the online platform Getter, a very important two-page memo about what we are confronting, we in the West, at the hands of what he describes as Islam, what I come to describe as Sharia and Sharia supremacism. He entitles it Free Speech. Why can't we talk about Islam? And we're going to do just that with Malcolm Pearson. My Lord, it's good to have you with us, sir. Happy New Year, and thank you for this latest act of courage.
Same to you, Frank, and a great honor to be on your program.
Well, the honor is surely ours. Let me ask you a little bit of this, the flavor of your essay. It is a multi-point indictment, I think it's fair to say, of the teachings and traditions and practices of Islam, if you will, or certainly those enshrined in Sharia, many of them drawn from the example of the individual we're told is the perfect man, Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. Give us some of the high points of the things that are concerning to you and should be, I think, to all of us.
My worry, and all this has been now for 10 years or so, is that you can't talk about it. As soon as you start trying to talk about Islam, you're accused of a thing called Islamophobia. And, you know, when you think that Islam or Islamism, whatever you want to call it, political Islam, radical Islam, has inspired over 40,000 fatal attacks worldwide since 9/11. You know, that's over five a day. And it is, therefore, it is the modern world's most violent religious ideology. And there's a very good summary of it on the religionofpeace.com website, which is not for the faint-hearted, let me warn you. But so the first thing I want to do is to try and talk about it, because I have been trying for 10 years in the Lords, British House of Lords. And, you know, every time I raise the question, I'm accused of being an Islamophobe. And that's a very misguided word. When you think, well, as I say, 40,000 fatal attacks, well, over five a day since 9/11. And therefore, my main point in issuing this 18-bullet-point memorandum is to try and get a conversation going, because at the moment you just can't talk about it. And the first thing surely must be to learn a bit about it and then be allowed to talk about it freely with our Muslim friends, who are, of course, the vast majority of Muslims in your country and my country and Europe and elsewhere. The vast majority are peaceful, decent people. But at the radical or political or Islamist end of the spectrum, they're the most dangerous people on the planet. And the question is, how do we sort of, the big question is, how do we help our Muslim friends, you know, to actually stand up to and differentiate themselves clearly from the violence?
Point six in your memorandum, Lord Pearson, in which you talk about the Quran itself and its injunctions to the faithful. Tease that out for us, if you would.
Well, I mean, devout Muslims, I mean, one of the basic, well, they must obey, they have to obey the Quran and follow the example of Muhammad's life. I mean, that is the essence of Islam. And the Quran does contain over 100 verses which encourage Muslims to kill or subdue non-Muslims. Now, there's a caveat to that, because some of the Quran's earlier verses, when Muhammad was living in Mecca before he'd moved to Medina, are more peaceful. But the trouble is that in Islam there is this controversial tenet of, it's called abrogation, whereby the peaceful early verses of the Quran, in other words, the verses of peace, are cancelled by the later verses, the verses of the sword. And whatever the theological arguments are behind that, and they're very dense, and the jihadists actually are inspired by the violent verses to kill Muslims who don't agree with them, and the rest of us.
So let me just clarify that when you speak of the earlier passages versus the later passages, you're talking about the chronological flow of the book, not necessarily their placement in the Quran, which is very confusing, it happens.
Well, it's all over the shop. It's not in chronological order.
It's very hard to make sense of it in that regard.
If you look at Muhammad's life, he was born in 570, and he left Mecca in 622 and went to Medina.
The Hijaz,
where
as they call it.
You know, he propagated his faith and all this, and he lay low for 5 years. But it's an historical fact, I think, which isn't disputed, that when he was strong enough to do so, he and built up his followers, he actually took Medina over in 627. And in that year, at a thing called the Battle of the Ditch, 627, he ordered the beheading of 600 Jews in one afternoon. And Islam went on to conquer most of the known world. So the Crusades were historically a response to 400 years of Muslim aggression. And I think we ought to be able to talk about this.
This is all of particular timeliness, it seems to me, because we have recently witnessed the confirmation by the United States Senate of a man by the name of Rashad Hussein to be the new, I should say now, U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, which, as you may know, Lord Pearson, is the senior diplomatic post in the United States government for advocating on the part of people who are denied religious liberty, many of whom, let's be honest, at the hands of Sharia supremacists. And the fellow, Rashad Hussein, is a man who is lifted up by, among others, Barack Obama as having memorized the entire Quran, which suggests he understands, as a devout Muslim, it is his duty to follow, you know, the 100 verses that he could presumably repeat on command that call for violence against those religious minorities, among others. So this is a very concerning development, needless to say, that we will see U.S. government policy viewed not on the basis of, you know, our traditional commitment to religious freedom, but through the prism of what the Quran tells a devout Muslim is permissible and impermissible. And I just wonder, as you've seen this in your own country, with the application of various other provisions and principles and traditions and dictates of the Quran, notably the treatment of captured non-Muslim women. How does that translate into practice in the United Kingdom at the moment?
Well, the I mean, you are actually talking about, I think, the greatest scandal in British social history, which is known as, well, certainly over the last 200 years or so, known as our grooming gang scandal, whereby literally thousands of British girls have been raped by Muslim men in millions of rapes. And there's awful, a tremendous amount about this out there, and these wretched girls are, you know, acquired one way or another and abused for years by networks of Muslim men. Now, when I say Muslim men, I'm now told, I will be told, oh, well, you're being Islamophobic. But actually, I can give you the sort of technicalities behind when I say millions and thousands of girls. I mean, you've got 1,400 girls raped over a 10-year period in Rotherham in one town alone. And our media only dare to talk about Asian men or men of Pakistani origin, which, of course, doesn't amuse our Sikhs and Hindus, who've complained about this, but to no avail.
Seemingly being
so this
lumped in with
this particular
sort
of practice, following the example. I mean, they have to, you know, they follow the Quran, the example of the Prophet. And Muhammad did sanction the rape of non-women, captive women. Now, take whichever way you want. But the radical Muslims, call them what you will, the Muslim men who have been forming into these gangs, they will quote the tenet in the Quran, which what your right hand possesses.
This is particularly relevant, sir, because we had a conversation yesterday on this program with Robert Spencer, who, of course, is one of our great experts on Sharia and its tenets. And he points out in his reporting at jihadwatch.org that we're now getting reports on a somewhat regular basis, at least, that men engaged in the rape of such women are actually reciting the Quranic precept under which they're doing it as they're engaged in this violation. It's just unbelievable. And again, to your point, that we're not allowed to talk about it. And that's fundamentally wrong. It is scandalous. And it can only, you know, incite more of this kind of behavior. So before we run out of time, I did want to return with you to some of your recommendations as to what must be done in light of all of this, among other things, of course, talking about it. But what else are you suggesting your government should do, and arguably others in the free world as well?
I think what I'm suggesting, I think, would apply to you. I mean, our government doesn't even know how many mosques we have, which is over 2,000, let alone what's being taught in them. And in our madrasas, the school attached to each mosque, they don't inspect them, they don't know. And it doesn't intend to find out, because that would be Islamophobic. Okay. And so I've suggested to our government, and I sent it to the government yesterday, our government could, and I suggest yours probably should too, is start finding out, recording, bugging, what is going on in our mosques, and perhaps even more dangerous, our house mosques, and which are the small sort of private ones. And we should imprison or deport the jihadist imams, the imams who are calling down the wrath of Allah upon us, should simply be taken out of the picture. And the same thing would go for our madrasas, I say, which are schools attached to each mosque. I mean, that is slightly shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted, because they've been doing this for many years. And that's something they could do. And then Austria has now put a ban on the foreign investment in Islam, and we could do that too.
Funding, right? Notably, yeah, for building more mosques, yeah, from Saudi Arabia,
exactly,
and other sources.
And scholarships and courses at universities, which you suffer from badly too. And so on. But the Baroness Cox, the wonderful Baroness Cox, who you know, she has a bill in the British Parliament which would give our Muslim wives, the protection of our civil law, which at the moment they don't have.
Because
a Muslim man can have four wives, and he only needs to say, "I divorce you," three times to each of them to get rid of them and have another one.
Now,
and this is a major scandal. But
let me
the
just ask
won't
you.
Touch it.
The reason, yeah, why Muslim women in the United Kingdom do not enjoy the protection of your civil law is what?
Because their marriage don't have to be registered under our civil law. Most of them, poor darlings, they come over here from Pakistan, they have a Muslim marriage, and they think they're married, but they're not.
And that's because they're being married pursuant to Sharia law, and the court system in the United Kingdom now has its own kind of parallel Sharia court system in which these matters are adjudicated. Is that right?
There are at least 80 of these things here. And the government, of course, could back Caroline Cox's bill. I mean, it's unbelievable, but the bill has had 9 supportive second readings in the House of Lords. 9. Where everyone, hours and hours, everyone is in favour of the bill. Except
and
the government.
And yet it doesn't get passed.
Very often the bishops of the Church of England aren't all that helpful either, but we let that one go. And the government just won't do it because they'll be accused of being Islamophobic by our Muslim men.
Let me conclude very quickly, sir, because we're almost out of time with you, on what may be your most important recommendation, which is working with what you call mild Muslims, the vast majority, and I think that's right, certainly in the United States, who are presumably as interested in having an alternative to Sharia as the rest of us, because in quite a number of cases, they fled their countries of origin because they wanted to get away from it.
You see, we've got to try and get them organized and support them and all that. And there are a couple of signs of hope. One, of course, is the Abraham Accords between Israel, the United States, the Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, started off actually by Jared Kushner just over a year ago. And that is working. That is pro-Israel, anti-Iran, and that is a sign of hope. And there is another one, which I'll end you with, which is the Grand Mufti of Egypt and 142 other muftis worldwide supporting him, has described the jihadists as criminals. And the Grand Mufti of Egypt is about as near the Muslim gets to a pope. And he's planning to come over here in May and talk and answer questions. So there is a sign of hope. And I and others are trying to get our government, behind that sort of initiative. And all the Muslims who don't actually want to live the life, or the jihadist, or the radical, or the political Islam,
or submitting to it at the very least.
I mean, they're not very good, but
I think that passage or the proclamation requires a very close reading. But I think it could be possibly very hopeful, and I certainly endorse what you're saying about the tenets of authoritative Islam codified in Sharia and the practices of those who believe they must faithfully implement it, the so-called Sharia supremacists. It is not Islamophobic to be fearful of these people. That suggests it's a mental disorder. It is certainly not. It is eminently sensible, and it must inform our policies if we're to protect not just our countries, but Western civilization from what these people have in mind with the global caliphate.
We've had a near squeak over here because the Muslims, the more aggressive forward ones, were trying to make Islamophobia into a criminal offense.
They're trying it here, too.
And they still are.
Yes.
But we managed to head it off because our security services and everyone said, well, if Islamophobia becomes a criminal offense, I mean, how can we watch the thousands of people, and as soon as we do.
Thank you, Lord Malcolm Pearson, Baron of Rannoch. Thank you most especially for your courage and your clarity on these points, but thank you as well for joining us here at the start of a very important new year.
Get your listeners to read the memo.
And it's your posting at Getter, is that right? And that's Malcolm Pearson at Getter?
I think it's M. Pearson or Lord Pearson.
M. Pearson, Lord Pearson. Look around for Malcolm Pearson. He's a man to watch for sure. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again very soon if you
would. Might be Lord Mills, Pearson. I don't know. But anyway, it's there, I'm assured.
Next up, we'll be speaking with Ben Weidgarten about some of this and more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest, one of my personal favorites whenever we can catch up with him here at Secure Freedom Radio. His name is Benjamin Weingarten. He has been prodigiously impactful with his myriad essays and articles in publications like The Federalists and Newsweek. In addition, his terrific book about Ilhan Omar, entitled American Ingrate. He is a senior fellow at the London Center for Policy Research and a fellow at the Claremont Institute, and a columnist for Newsweek and senior contributor at The Federalist and good friend. We're always delighted to have him with us. Ben, welcome back and Happy New Year to you, my friend.
Frank, Happy New Year. Hopefully a better one than last year. And thanks, as always, for the kind introduction.
Well, I hope it is better. I'm not sure that there's much prospect of that, but we're going to certainly do our part to try to make it come out right. And you're part of that, Ben, with your admonitions about some of the challenges we're facing that we need to rise to in this new year. One of which is a woman that I just mentioned. She comes to mind in connection with the Sharia supremacist operations that we were just discussing with Malcolm Pearson from the United Kingdom. Talk a little bit about Ilhan Omar, if you would, in connection with what seems to be her inveterate anti-Americanism. She's been called out for this by a candidate who was running against her by the name of Cicely Davis, who I saw had a very powerful condemnation of Representative Omar for her denunciation of the liquidation of Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian terrorist, by Donald Trump 2 years ago. What's the role that she's carved out for herself, that is to say, Congresswoman Omar? And are these criticisms of her as essentially pro-Sharia and anti-American warranted, do you think?
Well, as I argue and I document extensively in my book, American Ingrate, Ilhan Omar and the Progressive Islamist Takeover of the Democratic Party, if you were to apply the Russian collusion standard of scrutiny to Ilhan Omar, what you would find is an almost unfathomably large raft of links, ties, and or coordination, in fact, and coordination between Ilhan Omar and those with deep Islamic supremacist ties, both foreign and domestic, which of course we can see manifest themselves in both the rhetoric and the policies that Ilhan Omar has endorsed at home and abroad with respect to Islamic supremacist forces at home and abroad. And so, as I argue in that book, Ilhan Omar personifies the unholy left Islamist alliance that has existed for years in this country, but she represents a uniquely dangerous sort of manifestation of it, in no small part because she sits on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. She is a national figure, and perhaps most importantly of all, and I think this was really one of the major points in writing that book, she is not only held up as a leader in the Democratic Party, but she's been protected time and time again by the Democratic establishment. And what I argued was that when they sort of formed ranks around her to protect her from the backlash against her obviously anti-Semitic comments several years ago, that was the telltale sign that the Democratic Party was completely enthralled to its anti-American, pro-Islamist wing. And it's quite a contrast when you look at how the Republican establishment treats its equivalent of squad members, not in terms of their radicalism, but in terms of their anti-establishment credentials. They very rarely, if ever, defend them. And you look at Democrats, and they not only defend the squad, but the squad is the Democratic Party. And we see that, of course, reflected in the policies of the Biden administration. And that is a huge national security threat to this country.
Talk a little bit about what you see this woke ruling class up to, Ben Weingarten, and how, you know, those of us who don't want to go there should respond.
Well, of course, the first level of responding is acknowledging the size, scope, and nature of the problem. And as I've termed it in a recent piece at The Federalist, you have to know what time it is. And if you don't know what time it is, you're going to be completely ill-equipped to deal with what has really been a whole of society onslaught on wrong thinkers using every lever of power, public and private, to pursue anyone who dares dissent from ruling class orthodoxy, which I describe in a recent piece at Newsweek as being sort of wokest scientist. There's basically been, really since the summer of 2020, an anti-cultural revolution that has rolled through this country. And the ruling class, particularly when it comes to federal authorities, have elevated dissenters to constituting a national security threat or a threat to public health, and use that pretext to engage in a total assault on our liberties, starting with the First Amendment, but of course, including a whole slew of other natural rights as well. And as I document in this latest piece at Newsweek, it's been codified in a series of policies and proclamations, not least of which includes the Biden administration's first of its kind so-called national strategy on countering domestic terrorism, terror bulletins that have been put out for the last year, of course, the FBI/DOJ directive to pursue parents who dared to challenge school boards about indoctrinating their children in racial Marxism, masquerading as critical race theory, in addition to, of course, those who have criticized the draconian lockdowns with respect to coronavirus. And I lay out in that piece that there are really three buckets that the ruling class has used to claim that dissenters constitute a threat to the country and use that as a justification to clamp down on them. And those include, of course, challenging questions about election integrity in 2020 and going forward. The New York Times on January 1 of this year wrote a piece saying every day has been an insurrection since January 6th because largely Republicans have dared to seek to implement measures at the state level to ensure election integrity, as opposed to the election integrity eroding policy that led up to 2020. Again, critical race theory. You can't dare challenge critical race theory because you'd be challenging the ideology of the regime and the ability of the regime to indoctrinate students in public schools and private institutions in that ideology. And then lastly, of course, in terms of the draconian coronavirus policies and proclamations, which led to what I argue are the arbitrary and capricious suspensions of our natural rights on and off for months and now years on end. The ruling class cannot tolerate dissent to these policies, but they have a real problem, which is that they paid a massive political price for it in 2021, and they face a massive political price for it now going into 2022. And the question is going to be, will they squeeze ever more tightly onto the powers that they've tried to usurp? Or as a political existential imperative, will they relent to some extent, not, of course, on the basis of principle, but on a political basis? And that's yet to be seen. We'll see how this year goes. Based on this first week of seeking to further exploit January 6th, I don't have very high hopes that the ruling class is going to relent anytime soon.
Yeah, I so appreciate that, Ben. We had a long chat with Darren Beatty about the January 6th investigation by this committee and the blind spots that it clearly has with respect to information that doesn't fit the official narrative about who was responsible for it, the character of the event, and who is now, as you say, trying to exploit it for political ends. I suppose most worrying is this idea that we must jettison the filibuster in the Senate in order to enact legislation on the election front that would effectively make permanent the rule of this ruling class, as you put it so well. This is frightening in the extreme, and the canceling and the suppression of information and the banishing of people from social media platforms and the like, that is all part of the agenda enforcing the narrative, makes, I think, your admonitions exceedingly important and very timely. Let me turn to one other that you've been, I think, bringing similar kind of clarity to bear on, and that is the role being played by some in the financial sector in essentially enabling the mortal threat that you rightly point out emanates from the Chinese Communist Party. Kind of a poster child in a recent piece you had at Newsweek for this is a fellow by the name of Ray Dalio. Tell us a bit about him and why what he is saying, to say nothing of what he's doing, is so troubling.
I'd put Ray Dalio on a similar plane to Larry Fink at BlackRock in the way of financial masters of the universe who really personify and serve as the tip of the spear representation of woke capital and most of our ruling class more broadly, but in playing a unique role as what I would argue to be the leading unregistered foreign agents on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party in America. And not only that, of course, but individuals who play a massive role in steering billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars, effectively in capital into effectively the coffers of the Chinese Communist Party. Because, of course, any business entity that operates in China or subject to the rules of China, at the end of the day, is an organ of the Chinese Communist Party or could be operationalized into one at any given time should the CCP dictate it. And Dalio himself, of course, runs the largest hedge fund in the world in terms of assets under management, Bridgewater. He has been a stalwart defender of increasing investment in communist China for decades now. Speaks arguably, I would say glowingly, and I capture a lot of his comments about sort of the wisdom of the CCP, and essentially makes the case that those in the financial services industry and beyond have been making for decades to justify their dealings with the Chinese Communist Party. That, look, the Chinese Communist, China's economy is growing, America's looks stagnant, so we're going to bet on a couple horses at the same time. But of course, this is in effect aiding, abetting, and enabling our worst adversary, because capital, and particularly foreign capital, is the lifeblood of the CCP. And not only that, but this inextricably intertwined relationship has put us into a deathly bear hug that Communist China has us in. If we were to decouple and break that relationship, all of the strength that comes from us, that the Chinese Communist Party has used to build itself up into our most formidable adversary, would fall away. It's not to say that suddenly the threat of China would cease if we could actually break every supply chain and take every last U.S. dollar out of the coffers of the Chinese Communist Party, kick every single Chinese Communist Party related entity out of U.S. capital markets and beyond. It wouldn't be snap your fingers that tomorrow the threat erodes, but it would obviously wound it potentially fatally in its rise. And those like Ray Dalio, who continue to support integration and engagement with Communist China, put America last. They put America's national interest last. And the profit motive that's associated with it is totally short-sighted, because the question is always at what cost? And it's the cost not only of our national soul, but ultimately our survival. And the question that ought to be posed to every one of these business leaders who continues to support our engagement with Communist China is, do you want your children living in a world where Communist China is the hegemonic power? And if they answer yes, well, we've lost.
The question, I think, in addition to that is, do they think that they would benefit if there were such an outcome? And you're a more astute observer of history than I, Ben Weingarten, but my sense of it is history is chock-a-block with people who calculated that they could bring to power socialists or communists and found themselves to be the first put before the firing squads, or hung for that matter, when it turns out that the revolution is complete and they are regarded as untrustworthy individuals and dispatched. And I don't wish anybody any harm, but I hope that Ray Dalio and Larry Fink, as you say, of BlackRock, are mindful of that history, because they're not only selling out our country, in my view, and they're doing it for what seems to be pretty much their own personal greed. But to the extent that that fate awaits them, and I think it certainly does if they succeed in further enabling and empowering and emboldening what you rightly describe as our worst enemy, then they will be, I think, joining that long line of people who miscalculated terribly the consequences of their betrayal of their country. Ben Weingarten, there's so much more to talk with you about. Again, I appreciate what you do in your various outlets, notably at The Federalist and at Newsweek, and with your periodic visits with us. I hope that we'll make a mutual resolution for the new year that you will be a more frequent guest on this program and our television show, Securing America, as well as possible, because I think your voice is extraordinarily important and your grasp of the challenges that we're facing as a country is, well, unparalleled among people certainly of your generation. So I know you'll keep up the good work, and I look forward to helping you do it here with us in the days ahead. In the meantime, thank you for joining us, and we'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Jeremy Dye about the very important development of a federal judge staying the efforts of the Biden military punish Navy SEALs for saying thanks but no thanks to the COVID vaccine. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our first-time guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Jeremy Dyes is his name. He is an attorney and a special counsel for litigation and communications for a group that I admire tremendously. Its name is First Liberty. It's run by an old friend by the name of Kelly Shackelford. It is a force for good in a very difficult moment in our nation's history, specifically bringing legal counsel and both defense and offense to bear in the lawfare space, I guess one might say, on behalf of freedom, freedom of religion in many cases, freedom of other kinds that are fundamental to our country, to our constitutional republic, and the guarantees of liberty that are enshrined in that constitution. Jeremy, I am thrilled to have a chance to talk with you about a case in which what you do is on display at the moment on behalf of Navy SEALs, those highly trained, extraordinary warriors who are now, among other elements of our armed forces, at risk of being forced out of the service with the loss of all of those skills and training and other human capabilities that are, if anything, more needed now than at any time in our history. Tell us a little bit about the case, the people that you are helping with it, and the state of play.
I appreciate that, Frank, and thanks for having me. Yeah, the Navy SEALs, I think everybody knows, are the elite warriors on the face of the planet, really. I mean, these are the guys that do all the most important missions in our country and have featured so richly in the last, 20 or so years during the war on terror. Several of those guys, 35 of them, as a matter of fact, we represent. And in addition to many others, they're kind of the representative head of a lot of our service members who have a religious objection to receiving the COVID-19 vaccine. And that puts them at direct odds with the Biden administration and the Department of Defense and its mandate that every member of the military get the vaccine. They've got a lot of reasons for that. Some of them object on the grounds that it was that the vaccine was developed or tested upon materials involving aborted fetal cells. Others have just spent a significant amount of time in prayer and Bible study and come to the conscientious conclusion that they can't they can't comply with that mandate. And as a result, the Navy has increased levels of threats against them during this entire time. And we'll get into kind of what that looks like or what it has looked like, I'm sure. But as of Monday, we had filed a preliminary injunction at the end of the year last year, argued it right before Christmas, and Judge Reed O'Connor, a district court judge in Fort Worth, he granted that preliminary injunction at the outset. And I think it's important to kind of quote a couple things that he said, and perhaps they're certainly more eloquent than I'm going to be. He says, "There is no COVID-19 exception to the First Amendment. There is no military exclusion from our Constitution." Taken together, I mean, what that really signals to the Department of Defense and the Navy is that trying to force a service member to choose between his or her faith and serving his or her country, that's abhorrent to the Constitution. It's against American values, and it's illegal. And I'm glad to see that, at least for now, and I suspect for the near future, the Navy's going to have to go back to the drawing board and rethink their position on this unlawful order.
Well, two questions. One is this procedural point. How likely is it that you would see the judge make this into a permanent injunction rather than a temporary?
I mean, one of the parts of the analysis, as you know, Frank, is that the court has to consider whether the parties are likely to succeed on their claims. And he very clearly said that they are. Now, of course, the Department of Defense, the Navy, they could appeal this decision to the Fifth Circuit. I would have a lot of other circuits in the country with less faith in, but I think the Fifth Circuit as well position to hear this case, and we're more than happy to take that appeal with them and defend them at the Fifth Circuit. And if we have to go to the Supreme Court, well, certainly we will. But for right now, I think what this says for the rest of the country is that there is at least a roadmap, a blueprint for other service members to follow. You know, one of the keys to the analysis for the court was that these guys had received kind of a rubber stamp denial. In fact, it's like a 50-step process that this has to go through when you request a religious accommodation. And almost all of them that have been fully denied have received the exact same template with the names and serial numbers and you know, rank changed on them all. And so there's no case-by-case individualized assessment, which is required under Navy policy, but they've ignored that policy just to simply, you know, force these guys into doing something that their conscience won't allow them to do. And so I think that's going to have major repercussions with this level of precedent in place for our men and women of the armed forces to follow. And there are several tens of thousands that are trying to figure that out right now.
And not a few of them who have actually already gone through those steps to seek this kind of relief. You mentioned the other services. I know that they have, to some extent, differing policies or different procedures. How binding would you anticipate this will be on anybody other than the Navy?
Yeah, look, I think because the judge based his order upon not just the Constitution, but RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and said, look, you've authorized, speaking about the Navy and the Department of Defense, you've authorized hundreds, if not thousands, of exemptions for other reasons than religious, but you've denied every single one of the religious accommodations that have come before you. In other words, you've approved zero religious accommodation requests, and yet you've offered hundreds and thousands of others to be able to be exempt for medical or administrative reasons or something more than that. Because you're exercising a preference for the secular over the religious, you've engaged in religious discrimination. And so I think that's going to have a massive impact upon the Navy. At least one federal judge has now declared that they've engaged in religious discrimination and unfavorable outcome. I think one of the lines that the judge used with that is that there is favoritism built into the order, into this mandate. And if that's the case, by treating people of a secular orientation more favorably than those of a religious, I mean, it's very open and obvious religious discrimination. And look, again, just remember what's going on with these guys. If they request a religious accommodation, they're being told to turn in their special warfare device, what you and I would call the Trident. And they're being kicked out of the special warfare division and put back into the regular Navy. It's kind of like asking an Olympic athlete to go back and play JV ball. It's a massive step down, and not why these guys joined the military. In some cases, they've been threatened with not only being kicked out with a dishonorable discharge, but that the Navy has been threatening to recoup the dollars that they have invested in training these guys to be Navy SEALs. That's like upwards of $2 million. During the hearing, actually, this is very touching in my mind. We had one of the SEALs testify and trying to kind of understand the hardship that he's been through. He says, well, look, I sustained a traumatic brain injury during combat, and I went to seek treatment for that. And there's a clinic that would be treating my traumatic brain injury, but because of this mandate and that I was unvaccinated, the Navy would not allow me to travel to receive the treatment that I needed for a traumatic brain injury. And so he even said, look, I'll drive my own car by myself on my own time to a clinic that is indifferent towards my vaccination status. And the Navy said, no, you can't do that. That kind of thing, that just seems to add insult on top of injury and speaks of more vindictiveness than it does of caring for the guys who have sacrificed so much to protect our freedoms.
Jeremy Dyes is our guest, litigating attorney at First Liberty. He has just made a tremendously important point, and that is how outrageous this is. That men, and I don't know if there are any women in your team or not, but it's predominantly a men's operation, needless to say, or special forces in the Navy. But they are people who have made sacrifices, very considerable sacrifices, to say nothing of volunteering to put their lives on the line for us at any given moment. And they're being treated in this manner is outrageous. But honestly, I have to say, in a way, even more outrageous is that this is being done clearly without any regard for the national interest either. I mean, the personal stories are terrible and as I say, sufficient unto the day to call this, you know, something that should be condemned in the strongest terms. But Jeremy, the idea that at a time when we could find ourselves in desperate need for these kinds of highly skilled warriors, whether it's, you know, a war with China in the offing, whether it is operations in Ukraine that the president seems, you know, quite set on defending, whether it is the prospect of a conflict in the Middle East between Iran and Israel, for example, or any number of other places where things could go seriously bad very quickly. This is no moment to be taking these individuals out of our most elite forces, the very tip of the spear, as they say. And I say that in particular because, as I'm sure you know, and certainly your clients do, if you take somebody out of a unit, of the SEAL teams, in this case specifically, you are dismantling that team. It's not just a question of throwing somebody else in or letting them operate without that individual, because they bring certain unique capabilities and skills and all that expensive training and the like. And so it's a devastating blow, both to these individuals, yes, but to the teams of which they are part, and that we are in urgent need of having at full strength all the time.
Yeah, there's no question that this mandate is a direct threat to our national security. And I think the court recognized that. Of course, he based most of his decision upon the religious freedom implications of the court or of the Navy's mandate. But he was quick to point out that, you know, 99.4% of the Navy is vaccinated. We're talking about 0.6% that are currently unvaccinated. But during the pendency of most of this pandemic, these our clients were deployed. They were engaged in large-scale training operations and a variety of other things that they did all perfectly safely and were declared to be able to be deployed and go wage the nation's battles as called upon. But just because they asked for religious accommodation and have been at least in a holding pattern, if not denied, they've been rendered non-deployable during this entire time. Now, keep in mind the unfair treatment that's in place here, because those with a medical or administrative accommodation that have been granted, they have always, even during the pendency of their applications, been declared to be deployable. But just because you've requested a accommodation based upon a religious belief and conscience objection, you're rendered non-deployable. You're basically riding a desk rather than riding a tank or whatever it is that the SEALs ride into battle with. And that level of discrimination, it should be open and obvious to everyone. And I think it is open and obvious to almost all Americans of how egregious that is towards the Constitution and our values as a nation. It just appears to be the policymakers in the DOD and the Admiralty that don't quite get it. You can't treat them differently here. And as again, as Judge O'Connor said, the COVID-19 pandemic provides the government no license to abrogate those freedoms.
Well, this is a huge development, needless to say, and I give you full credit for having brought the case effectively and brought the court to this at least interim judgment. And I pray that it will be both, you know, further validated and made permanent by this particular judge, and as necessary, that people up the food chain in the court system will be affirming his ruling. This brings me to a larger and final question to you, Jeremy, and that is, you spoke about it in your opening comment, the kind of attitude that is being exhibited by the Biden administration towards people of faith and, you know, the practice of religious freedom is troubling, to say the least. There's another case that First Liberty has been involved in, and I know you're aware of it, if not directly involved in it, and that is a question of whether an organization can provide dog tags for the purpose of identifying men and women in the services, that have on one side their name and other relevant information, but on the other, a biblical verse. And I understand that for quite some time, this has been
an accepted practice. Somebody recently complained, and now those in at least the Army, as I understand it, are being told that they cannot have such dog tags. Tell us what's going on here, and does this bespeak, again, another affront to religious liberty?
Yeah, it certainly does. And of course, I'd encourage folks to go to firstliberty.org to get the whole backstory of this case. It really is quite moving to hear, because there have been so many of these members of the military that have requested these dog tags. Now, these are not the official dog tags, of course, that the military issues to all of their service members, but these are other dog tags that are purchased at their own cost. These members buy them by the lot to provide, because they provide a source of inspiration and hope and encouragement to these guys. And when you're going into battle, I mean, that's a pretty important thing to have, you know, beside you. It steals your courage, which is exactly what we want them to have. But it's now a cruel insult to our service members to deny them that source of inspiration, hope, and encouragement simply because the logos of our branches of the military appear next to or on the opposite face of a religious message. And again, that's kind of open discrimination based upon the fact that they're not denying them if you have a secular message that's out there. It's just that someone has twisted the law in a cruel attempt to deprive our service members from having these what are called shields of strength. And I would just like to see the military officials ignore those messages of those who would make their living by simply being offended by everything, and instead recognize that the law protects shields of strength from actually being discriminated against simply because their products contain a religious message of hope and encouragement. That's a basic thing we ought to do for our leaders. I'm gonna kind of mix things here and go back to what the Judge O'Connor said in the Navy SEALs injunction, when he said, the Navy, and this can apply across the disciplines here, the Navy service members in this case seek to vindicate the very freedoms they have sacrificed so much to protect. It's up to you and me to make sure we stand beside those guys who are defending everything, or sacrificing everything to protect our freedoms. They've given up a lot. They do not have to give up their religious liberty when they go back into the military. And that includes here with Shields of Strength too. So we are honored to stand beside Shields of Strength. We're just as pleased as we could be to defend the Navy SEALs, because they protect our freedoms. The least we can do is provide them pro bono legal defense to make sure that their religious freedom is not questioned during this important time.
Amen. Jeremy Dyess, very well said, both here and in court. Thank you for your leadership and that of all of First Liberty. It's a terrific outfit. I commend it to people for charitable contributions, if you're so inclined. How can people get in touch with your organization and make a donation or otherwise support your work?
Yeah, look, I'd encourage them to go to firstliberty.org and sign up, especially for our First Liberty Insider email that comes out each week to give you a real inside look at the cases that we're working on every day here at firstliberty.org, including the OSHA mandate, which is kind of related to what we've been talking about, that the Supreme Court will hear argument about on Friday.
Very, very important. We'll look forward to hearing back from you or your team about that very important case. God bless you, sir. Keep up the good work. Come back to us with updates if you would. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.